on the coronavirus front. As always, good news here. Let me start out with this. This is always like good news stories. You can read the whole thing on the site. It's right on the homepage there. Lungs damaged by coronavirus can repair themselves in 3 months. That's a good story. I like those stories. And I also want to point out that that story about Big Ten athletes having myocarditis was wrong. It was just incorrect. So that's been withdrawn as well. We really have to be careful and try to keep track of what's going on. It's not always easy, but there are lots of things happening, and many of them are good things. They just don't make the news. Here's some headlines from the coronavirus file. This is interesting. Now, I've read this, and they appear to be legitimate documents. The World Bank has records, its own records, showing that COVID-19 test kits were being exported in 2017 and 2018 by name. This is 2 years before it was formally even named COVID-19. It's right there in the story. You can see it. And that's a very interesting one. Don't know what to make of that yet. I'm watching it. Okay. Here's another one I want to get Henry to talk about in a couple of minutes. And I don't know how to pronounce it. Henry, welcome back, first of all. Thanks for being here.
Well, it's good to be back, Jeff. I didn't see your story about the 2017, but
that's
can
right at the
tell
top.
From just what you said, I don't believe that for 1 second. So
yeah, well, I need to study it more.
I mean, the stories you're coming up with are just, there's massive disinformation out there. And, you know, any story that's coming out with naming the virus in 2017 and talking about this virus is just nuts. Yeah.
Well, they have alleged data right here. So you'll have to take a look at it. Tell me what you think. Yeah. It's WITS.worldbank.org, World Integrated Trade Solution. And it's right there. Did somebody create this whole thing? Could be. I don't know. So we'll ask you to look at that and get back to us. I know what you're thinking. Now here's another one. This I don't know how to pronounce this one. It's an antiviral. I sent it to you. Galidesivir.
Right.
Will that be the antiviral to the rescue? We've got remdesivir. This is another one. So we've got two ways to go. We've got a bunch of, it's like a racehorse, vaccines in the Derby, and then we got antivirals.
There's a lot of antivirals. The one you mentioned is very similar.
Can you pronounce that?
Remdesivir.
You get $5 if you can.
Galidesivir. I mean, they all end the same way, desivir.
Well, I got
remdesivir.
That part. So you think it's galidesivir. All right.
Correct.
Well, the check's in the mail, if you're right.
These things are named scientifically, and basically the names mean something. I mean, the vir is for virus. And desivir means it basically attacks the virus. It's a drug that attacks the virus.
DES is in destruction? Destruction?
No, the DES is something specific as to how...
G-A-L-I-D. Galidesivir.
Destroy, right. Destroy or inhibit. I'm not sure what death exactly
means.
Right.
How about
means,
deconstruct? But whatever. It's a negative
term. But they end the same way, and it's basically saying it's an antiviral. And in fact, it's not only an antiviral, it's very, very similar to remdesivir. They're both, mm-hmm. nucleotide analogs. So basically, this is how the genetic information is copied. It just uses four letters, and this takes one of those letters and modifies it so that when it goes, it's the RNA of the virus. It remdesivir apparently terminates the growing chain. So when it's copying the genetic information, it kind of stops that copying so that it can't copy its genetic information and it can't grow. And this other one works the same way. It's a nucleoside analog of the A. There's four letters. A is one of them. And it's a variation of the A, but it's kind of set up so there's going to be somewhat specific for viruses as opposed to the A that you use, the humans use. So it's not toxic to humans. Humans can still copy their DNA, but viruses can't copy their RNA. And therefore, it inhibits the ability of the virus to grow. It's in the same category as ACT for combating HIV. That was one of the that was really the first antiviral that was used.
AZT
for HIV AIDS, and it's the same thing. It also is a nucleoside analog, and it inhibits reverse transcriptase, which is another polymerase. So all of these kind of work the same way. They get in the way of the enzyme that's copying the genetic information.
Like acyclovir.
Right. So there's a whole series of nucleoside analogs. And nucleoside analogs have been around, for a very, very, very long time. I mean, they were initially developed for anti-cancer agents. And again, it's the same thing.
You're breaking up there, Henry. We may be losing him again. If you can hear me, Henry, I don't know if you're on a cell phone, turn in a different direction. That sometimes helps. You may not be on a cell. I don't know.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
There you go. Now I got you. Yeah.
Okay. These nucleoside analogs basically are involved, get incorporated into the DNA or the RNA and kill whatever is using them to copy their genetic information. So they were originally developed for cancer cells. Cancer cells divide a lot. They divide more frequently than normal cells, and therefore they were used to kill off cancer cells. They didn't have as much specificity as you'd like, so some cells like white blood cells that divide a lot would incorporate it, and you'd get toxicity. You had the same type of problems with AZT, that it would cause some problems with liver. So that one of the issues of all of these drugs is side effects and unwanted.
What Henry's saying here, this goes way back, is that the original AZT and then the cocktail approach to treating AIDS came from a failed anti-cancer protocol. It didn't work, and they put it back on the shelf, and they pulled it out, and they decided that it did work. It did suppress some of the HIV activity. I don't have the science behind this, but that was where that came from. AZT wasn't originally an anti-cancer. Yes, I remember that.
Right. So both of them are working the same mechanism. They're basically one of the letters in the four letters that are used to copy genetic information. And then for AIDS, they ended up with protease inhibitors, which basically would inhibit another enzyme that takes a long protein and chops it up into smaller pieces, and that process is also required in the virus's life cycle. And they ended up coming up with more protease inhibitors that had more specificity that really target the virus more than they did other cell types. And that's eventually what ended up turning the corner as far as HIV/AIDS was concerned. There was just a whole series of protease inhibitors that were used in combination. So there'd be a cocktail and there'd be several different drugs administered simultaneously, so the virus wasn't able to kind of mutate away from one drug, and they got positive results. So the one that you're asking about, the
Galidesivir
is another nuclear polymerase inhibitor, just like Remdesivir.
I just got an email. Oh, by the way, the point about Galidesivir is that Anthony Fauci's NIAID group just gave
$44 million.
Yeah, gave him $44 million to advance development of Galidesivir. Now, I got an email from somebody here. Hold on, let me read this to you, and you can comment on this, too. Finish your thought if you want, then I'll read this. Whatever you want.
Well, I was just going to say the part of that is because it's still, they just finished a phase one trial. So it's still in clinical trials. They haven't really got results yet for a broader trial like a phase three trial. So how well it works in a larger population is still being determined. Okay. So it's a little bit earlier stage. It's not really approved for use yet beyond these clinical trials.
All right. Here's somebody sent this in. Galidesivir is almost identical to natural ATP docking energy that COVID-19 uses. Galidesivir already has positive efficacy data from the Zika, Ebola, yellow fever, and Marburg viruses in animal trials. As you said earlier, they're in their first stage. Also positive data versus coronaviruses, flaviviruses, filoviruses, paramyoxiviruses, togaviruses, BUNYAVR, Bunavir, Marburg types, and arena. Galidesivir can cross the blood-brain barrier. Remdesivir cannot. That seems to be the point of this email I got. It crosses the blood-brain barrier. Remdesivir does not. That's what this person's saying.
Right. So, it's at an earlier state, so it's still in
animal
it's
trials.
Still in phase. No, it's already had a phase one human trial, and now it's going into a phase three.
Well,
human
Tony
trial.
Fauci likes it enough for $44 million, I guess.
Yeah, well, all of these trials require a lot of money, and basically, that's kind of what that funding is for. That it basically went through phase one, and they're supporting it to move into a phase three. Whenever you get into clinical trials, it ends up start costing a lot of money, especially when you get up to phase three, because you have to recruit a lot of people and then a lot of patients, and then you have to follow them because there's the potential for side effects, and it could take a while for those side effects to develop,
right.
And so
you read the story.
For a while.
You've got it. They are, as you say, they've moved on. They're moving along. I just wonder if the blood-brain barrier penetration aspect, as opposed to remdesivir, is some kind of a game changer.
I don't know. Most of the virus isn't in the brain. I mean,
we've heard some
virus,
stories about neurological issues, so maybe.
Right. The virus can attack a lot of different cell types because of the polybasic cleavage site and the fact that you have ACE2 receptors as well as the protease that is is widespread, and furin is the protease that that recognizes that polybasic Clavey site, and so the virus can attack many different cell types, including neurological cells. So, I mean, it's a plus if it can cross the blood-brain barrier, but it's not like that's the only place the virus goes. The virus is, you know, it starts out in the respiratory tract, and then it can go to other organs, and along those lines, the Penn State said that the numbers are lower. It wasn't that it doesn't cause myocarditis. It does. It just the frequencies that he was originally citing was an initial number, which was 35% of the cases.
It's very high.
It's a lower percentage, but it's still the same issue. It's just a matter of what percentage of the patients end up having that.
One more on Galidesivir, then we'll close that chapter for tonight. The person says it will receive an EUA, emergency use authorization.
Yeah, emergency use authorization.
That's probably Tony Fauci's work getting that done, but they'll get it done. So we'll see.
I've always been in favor
of antivirals rather than vaccines. I think that's the future.
Well, it'll take a combination, and again, it's to treat people that are already infected, whereas a vaccine is more of a prevention, and that's part of the reason that you'd like to have more long-term results with vaccines, because you're really giving it to people that are healthy. They haven't been infected yet. And so you're taking a healthy population and you're giving them a treatment, whereas the antivirals, they're already affected, and how well they work. And usually you end up requiring multiple antivirals, because if you're doing just a single drug, the virus will tend to develop resistance to it, that they'll find a way to not be affected by that particular nucleotide. They'll end up having resistance to incorporating that, and that if it's given, but the virus's polymerase doesn't incorporate it, then it doesn't have any effect. And so the viruses are pretty good at developing resistance, especially if they only have one target to worry about. So there's only one drug that's effective. There'll be a virus out there that isn't affected by that drug, and that virus, that mutated version will become dominant, and then there'll be resistance and it won't continue to work. And that's what typically happens with antivirals that aren't used in combination. And so there's something to be said for the combination use of them. And that's what Anthony Fauci said when remdesivir was first had its positive results in the clinical trial. He said it was a lot like AZT. It wasn't the be-all and end-all. It was not likely to work all by itself. It would have limitations, but it would be kind of a start. And it would be like AZT. The AZT, was the initial antiviral for HIV. Mm-hmm. And then other nucleotide analogs were developed. And then the protease inhibitors were developed. And turns out the protease inhibitors were more effective, because there were quite a few of them, and they targeted they were used in combination, and they're relatively cheap to make. They're small molecules, and that they have that ability. If they're small molecules, they're more likely to cross the blood-brain barrier. They're fairly cheap to make. They can be taken orally in a pill form, that you don't have to go in the hospital. You don't have to get an IV. And if you get several of them, they're effective, and you use them in combination, then you end up getting a positive result. But we're not there. Like I said, there's only one that's been approved for use so far. And it is having a positive effect, but it's not having such a positive effect that the number of deaths are significantly reduced. And that's what I was going to get to today. Today was kind of another milestone that had been passed, and that was with 190,000 Americans have now died using the Johns Hopkins tabulation, which is pretty much limited to the 50 states. There's a Worldometer, which is a little bit broader. They include, in addition to the 50 states, they include other Americans that really aren't covered, aren't monitored in the totals of each state. And those would include prisoners, the military, veterans that go to VA hospitals, Native Americans that are on Indian reservations, and other Americans that are in U.S. territories like Puerto Rico or Guam or the Virgin Islands. So they come up with a little bit higher number. It's 190,000 today with Johns Hopkins. The Worldometer has got 3,500 more. So they're currently at 193,524, actually, is what the total is as of this evening. And it was kind of weird because there were stories. Yeah, there were stories on this. Say, well, we crossed 190,000. Let's hope we don't get to 200,000. And that kind of, I mean, this was on the news. And it's kind of like, well, you can do all the hoping you want, but there's 1,000 people dying every day.
They can't do the math. They can't do the math. Simple math.
Yeah, right. And the basically, you know, it's a little lower on the weekends, but it's 5,000 to 6,000 people are dying every week. And if you're 190,000, you're 2 weeks away from 200,000. Yeah. And if you're 2 weeks away, these 10,000 that are going to die between today and, you know, 2 weeks from now, they're already in the hospital. They're already in the ICU. They're already near death. And 10,000 of them are going to die in the next 2 weeks. So your hopes aren't going to do a thing.
It's stupid.
They're going to die. That's the reality. So to come out and say, well, hopefully it doesn't get up to 200,000. And then their projections, the projections are that by December 1st, there'll be 300,000 dead. And by January 1st, there'll be 400,000 dead. So they're projecting 300,000 or 400,000 deaths. And these guys are saying, well, I hope we don't lose another 10,000, you know, from now till eternity.
That sounds like a typical television news reader.
It was just, I mean, when I heard that, I thought, are you nuts? I mean, yeah, it's not difficult math. If you're 10,000 away and they're reporting 1,000 are dying every day, to think that you're not going to get another 10,000 is just, there's nothing to hope for on that. That's a fantasy. And unfortunately, that's kind of where we are. There, like I said, there's a lot of misinformation. I'll take a look at this one that said the virus was named, you know, 2 or 3 years ago before it was, identified. I mean, people always
2017. It's in your email box. They're either fake documents or they're real. One, there's no middle ground. So
no, they're fake documents. It's just a matter of how they're presenting it as real. There is no way that you know it's being misrepresented one way or the other. I mean, SARS was an issue. It was 17 years ago. You kind of wondered why it didn't reappear sooner. There was little doubt that the virus was still around. It was in reservoirs. The main reservoir were bats. There was plenty of work that was out there that indicated there were other SARS-like viruses out there. There, including novel beta coronaviruses. After SARS, there was MERS, which is in the same category. Right. And so it was possible there was going to be another virus that was going to emerge eventually. There were researchers that were doing work on it, but it wasn't like this one was identified. The one that appeared was identified in 2017. I mean, there was a virus that there was isolated that I think was in 2013 or so, that was in bats. It was closer to this one than any other one. It was about 96% identical. There's since been another one that's 97% that nobody really talks about. But you know, it's in a reservoir, it's in a bat, but there was nothing that said that this was the one that was going to emerge or that it was going to change into what it became, because, you know, even 96% is still a little bit different. On a phylogenetic tree, it kind of would be closer as to what branch it was on. But in any event, the bottom line is that there are some major issues out there that are still predicting that things are going to deteriorate fairly dramatically in the upcoming month or so.
And the next 3 months, Henry, in my view, are going to be the worst 3 months in American history. Most difficult across the board. I don't care what discipline you're talking about. This has impacted virtually everything. It's going to be very difficult.
Well, I agree that it's going to be very difficult. A vaccine.
Turn your phone again. Turn your head around again a little bit if you're on a cell.
Yeah. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. There's little doubt that things are going to go downhill. The today's another holiday, and that's going to lead to another spike in cases. On Memorial Day, it went and it got cases up high enough, and the easing of the restrictions combined got the background to 40,000 a day from 20,000 a day. So it's in the 40,000 a day range, and there's still issues in some locations on whether people should wear masks. There's no real plan to attack the pandemic. There's, you know, Hail Mary. Well, it's not really quite a Hail Mary. Well, it's a Hail Mary for this year, that all of a sudden there's going to be a vaccine and things are going to get under control. The vaccine is difficult to see how the safety data is going to be in place by any time this year, because some of the issues with the vaccine can be long-term. Some of the issues can be viral enhancement, and that viral enhancement may be dependent somewhat upon what virus is circulating. And so there could be viral enhancement of the virus changes a little bit, and it's a little bit more different than the current virus, or the current virus might actually cause enhancement. And you won't necessarily see that at the beginning. It'll take, a reasonable number of cases to realize that there are more severe diseases being associated with those that got the vaccine over discovered those that didn't. But, you know, the idea that phase three is it goes up to 30,000 and there is a placebo control. So either a third or half of the patients who will get a placebo and you'll compare what the frequency of.
Turn your phone again, please.
Just
turn your head. Something. It faded out a little bit again.
Okay.
There you go.
It has to do with you know what the efficiency is going to be for the virus and how well the vaccine is going to work, and they're really not going to know because.
And the question is, which vaccine is Henry talking about? You all can make up your own minds on that. There's about, eight now? Something like that.
Yeah, but they're at different stages.
Which one are you primarily referring to? Which one do you allude to when you say vaccine?
Well, they all have the same issue. The two that are scheduled to be are furthest along in the clinical trials are Moderna and the one from Pfizer. And both of them are adenovirus that's got either the full spike gene or it's got just the receptor binding domain for the spike gene.
Is this an attenuated adenovirus or a dead adenovirus added? I have to add it while it's still alive, I guess. Do they kill it? Or is this just attenuated?
Yeah, this is just the genes that lead to the overexpression of the added gene. So they actually make the spike gene. So it's not really the adenovirus itself. It's just some of the genes of the adenovirus that cause the overexpression of the gene encoded by that encodes the spike protein. So,
okay.
So they're essentially making either a full spike protein or the receptor binding domain of the spike protein. The problem is that in both cases, it takes two injections. And they're like 3 to 4 weeks apart. So there's a long...
In both cases? No.
Correct. In both cases. And that's always a bad sign when you need two shots. The only reason you need two shots is because one shot's not good enough. You know, so they do the vaccination.
That's the psychology.
It really doesn't work that well.
Yeah.
And so you have to do a second one to get a high enough level. And that's a logistical problem. I mean, it means you have to go get a shot, and then you got to come back 3 or 4 weeks later and get another shot. So that means you need twice as many syringes, you need twice as much virus, you need people to return to get their booster. It's this package, this biological, you have to store it at minus 70 degrees centigrade. So you need liquid nitrogen to store it.
Well, I'm not going into that business.
Issue.
You just ruined it for me. I'm forgetting.
And there's a distribution situation. Yeah. And so it's something that... It's going to take a little while to get results. Even standpoint not fully immunized until about.
Well, Henry, what are the Russians doing? We haven't talked about the Russians. The Russian vaccine. What do we know? Do you know much about that? Well, your phone's going out again. I'm sorry. Can you turn again, please?
It's only really gone through a phase one trial. And so it's only been given to about 100 people.
Okay.
And so it's not as far along as the ones that I'm talking about with the U.S. So there's very little information on it. It basically says they gave it to 100 people. They didn't get any adverse effects from a small group.
Uh-huh.
Typically, if they give it to 100 people, most of those people are younger. They've got a good immune system. It's stacked to give a positive result. If they give it to 100 people, they haven't really done much of a broad application to see how well it's going to work in different age groups, in different genetic backgrounds. There's very, very little information on that. And I think in China it's the same thing. That it's an initial result. They've scheduled phase three trials, but they don't have data yet on phase three trials. The ones I'm talking about in the U.S. have already completed phase one. They've already initiated phase three. So they're basically taking their initial data and saying it works. And the trials the U.S. has done, from that standpoint, you can say the same thing. It works. But they don't know the side effects. They don't know how well it works in a variety of populations. And, there are all these issues. As you said, I think there maybe are eight different vaccines that have already entered clinical trials. So they're kind of getting started, but they're not at the level where you can say, it's fine. It works at such and such a level. And even the expectations aren't that high. I mean, the bar that has to be level is just 50% effectiveness. So that's not the most effective vaccine.
Is that who's looking for 50? If one of the vaccines passes
the US,
normal trials, and we say, okay, if it's 50% efficacy,
50%,
that qualifies
right.
it. Well. And what happens
to
the other half? They just get no response from it, or not marginally, I guess. Nothing.
Right. It's well into the better than nothing category, but that's about where it is. It's not that you got to get 60, 70, 80%. If it's 50% efficacy, then you're not going to achieve herd immunity. Even if you get 100% of the population to take the drug, the vaccine, and there's a reasonable amount of resistance, especially if it's developed in a very, very short time period, because there is no current coronavirus vaccine that's been shown to be safe and effective in a large group. It's a new target, which is somewhat different than, for instance, the swine flu. The swine flu was done in the same time frame. The swine flu started in the spring of 2009. It was available in limited quantities, but it was available for children in particular by the end of 2009. So it was done in an even shorter time period than is being projected in the most rosy projections for the COVID vaccine. But it was a little bit different in the sense that it was an influenza vaccine. And there have been influenza vaccines for many decades. And they're all made the same way, or all the modern ones are made the same way, where they actually use a virus from 1939 in Puerto Rico. And six of the eight genes come from that virus, and the only two that are different are the H and the N gene and the influenza. So for the swine flu, they just had to take the H and the N from the swine flu and add it to the other six. So it wasn't like it's a brand new treatment. It's just a new H and N, and they typically change the H&N every several years anyway. And you know, the current vaccine has four different viruses. So they've already done this with four different viruses. Then every year or two, one of those four kind of gets changed a little bit, and they come up with a new virus with the same six from 1939 and a new H and N. So it wasn't like it's a brand new virus and a brand new vaccine. It's just a slightly modified vaccine. In this case, it's a brand new vaccine. There were some experimental work that was done with MERS. It's never been approved. There's been some work that was done with the original SARS. That's never been approved. The companies that have the lead were already working on MERS and SARS. So they were already using this delivery system.
So they just kind of changed course a little bit and continued their research. That's what you're saying.
They just had to change the genes, correct. That as soon as China released the sequence in January, they had all the information they needed to actually make the vaccine. So they could quickly make the vaccine by just swapping out the spike protein for SARS-CoV-2 for the MERS spike gene or for the SARS spike gene. So they already had experience with it. The difference is they didn't get either the prior ones approved. They had data, they had animal models, you know, they had some initial data, but they didn't really go all the way to create a vaccine. So this is kind of a whole new area to go into. It's a coronavirus vaccine. There's no human beta coronavirus vaccine available. There's not even vaccines for the cold viruses that have been around for a while.
No.
Because the colds generally aren't that severe, and they would have the potential problem of A, having the virus mutate away from the vaccine, and B, there would be these potential enhancement effects. And the enhancement effect is one of the reasons that there's a lot of concern as to how easy it's going to be to make a coronavirus vaccine. It's because there's history of that happening with dengue, where they made a dengue vaccine, and it was there's a couple different serotypes of the dengue virus, and what happened is the vaccine worked against the one they were targeting, but it enhanced another serotype, and so people that got vaccinated for one serotype, it prevented that one, but it led to more severe disease with the other one, and so its net results wasn't really that positive because both targets were circulating, and the one that was enhanced caused more problems than the benefits for the one that was that it was effective again. And so there's concern that the same thing could happen with the SARS coronavirus. You could have the vaccine, which would work against the original Wuhan sequence, but you could have something like the Italian strain or a further evolved Italian strain that would be different enough that it would end up not being inhibited by the antibodies, but instead being enhanced by the antibodies, and it would make the new version of SARS-CoV worse than it would be if you didn't get vaccinated. And that's why the whole thing is a little bit tricky. You can get an idea of what's happening when you've got, you know, a large population that's vaccinated, and see you know, how that works out over time, and especially if the virus starts to change, whether it remains effective and it doesn't kind of go from inhibition to enhancement. And that's why I'm saying that things aren't going to get rushed out that quickly. This enhancement is well known to the scientists. They know that's a potential problem. And they know, you know, there's a host of potential long-term types of issues. And there's a lot of heterogeneity as to what this virus can do. It can attack the heart. It can attack the nervous system. And so how well the vaccine works for the different targeting problems
pass the blood-brain barrier either. It's Galidesivir, if it does, what we're being told it does.
A vaccine's not an antiviral.
Understood. No, I'm totally on the page with you here. I'm just suggesting if this antiviral...
The antibodies don't pass the blood-brain barrier. The antibody's a big molecule. These nucleotides are one letter. They're a little bitty thing. They're made with chemicals off the shelf. Complicated purification process, but it's a very small molecule. The antibody is a very big molecule, so it's not.
Do you have a laboratory in your basement, Henry? Do you have a secret laboratory somewhere where you go and do your work?
None of this information is new. I mean, to give you an idea, these nucleoside analogs. That was one of the things I was looking at doing my graduate work on in 1974. And it wasn't new in 1974. It was it was what the lab specialized in. So none of these things I'm telling you are something that just popped up in the last few
years. Well, I think I get that. I'm just wondering if you're still messing around in a laboratory somewhere, just having fun doing a little research here and there. Okay, last question here. This idea that the lungs that are damaged, notoriously, obviously, by coronavirus can repair themselves in 3 months, in not 100% of the cases, I think I read it was 85-ish, somewhere around there. That's very encouraging news. That's nice.
Yeah.
That's good news.
Well, almost all of the issues are going to be a continuum. You know, it really comes down to, you know, how old the person is. There were, you know, how long they were sick, whether they were on a ventilator. I mean, there's a whole series of potential problems.
Sure, variables.
From these viral infectors.
Yeah.
There's some people that are called long haulers who are actually sick for months. You know, they can't. They can't, you know, throw off the virus. They end up feeling better. They test negative on a PCR test, and they get tested a second time because they need two negatives to get discharged. All of a sudden, they're positive again, and they start getting more symptoms. And then it kind of comes and goes. It comes and goes, and so. Yeah, those types of people where they've had the infection for months are more likely to have a problem. This more of a long-term type of a thing. But lungs are just one of the many targets of this virus. And some of these targets, they have no idea, you know, what kind of damage.
No, we're still on a learning curve, that's for sure.
How long-lasting it is.
Yeah.
And,
all right.
So that's kind of where that stands. But I agree with you that the next 3 months are not going to be good. And things are going to go downhill, basically, because of the number of students that are going to get this virus. They're going to take it home and spread it. And
a lot of the White House suggested they stay at school.
It's moving into flu season.
They're not. The colleges are sending them home in many cases, or they're fleeing and running home in some cases. So the idea of containing it to a campus.
Yeah, the schools aren't going to keep it. The schools aren't going to keep them on campus if they're not holding classes. Yeah, they're virtual, and they'll say, you got a computer, just log.
Right. All right.
Okay.
Thank you, Henry.
We'll have more of an update on the number of cases. It's low over the weekend, but by Wednesday, you should have
it'll
a
take
better number.
A day after the holiday. Very good. Okay. Talk soon. You be well.
Okay. Take care. Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Okay. Dr. Henry Nyman, PhD, one of the world's top virologists. Very honored to have him as a long-term colleague here. All right. We'll be right back with you tomorrow night on Tuesday. Take good care, eat good food, build that immune system. Remember, our products are the best. Talk tomorrow.